You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today we're going to be talking about the archaeology records. You heard that right, plural, as in vinyl records. My guest today is Breck Parkman, retired senior state archaeologist with California State Parks and co-author of a chapter in the Routledge Handbook of Archaeology and Plastics about a collection recovered from a commune in Northern California that burned in 1969. Breck, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chelsea.
To start, can you give us a very brief overview of the Chosen family that lived at what is now Olympali State Historic Park in Marin County and how their headquarters became an archaeological site?
I sure can. In 1967, toward the end of the Summer of Love, anyone that remembers San Francisco remembers that it became overwhelmed with runaways. And as more and more runaways flocked to San Francisco to experiment and experience what was going on, more predators came, drug dealers came, and it started becoming a very violent place, whereas it had been a beautiful place. At that point, a lot of the original people who had created this Summer of Love started moving out, moving away, and they went on to found some really important communes in the American West, one of which was the Chosen family. Some of the folks living in San Francisco wanted to get away from that scene, and they banded together. It was a number of adults, mostly single adults who had kids, and they found a place to live, a place we call Olympali, which is a Coast Miwok word. Olympali was an old ranch, had a very large, beautiful mansion, and then a lot of outbuildings. This group of people banded together, put their money together, and they rented Olympali, and they called themselves the Chosen family because they decided they chose who would be part of their family. They didn't think they were special. It's not chosen like that, chosen by God or some deity. But the fact that they had chosen who would live with them made them the Chosen family. They were there for 2 years. They moved in right before Thanksgiving in 1967, and they were there for 2 years. They started out about 25 people strong, and it increased to over 50 while they were there as more and more people joined them. And then 2 years later, there was an electrical fire, and the mansion, which is where most of the people lived, burned to the ground. All the people got out alive, but they lost all their possessions, including the records that we're talking about, and then they were eventually forced to move elsewhere. So that's the Chosen family. They're still around. Some of my good friends are members of the Chosen family, my people I interview every now and then, and which is always a good experience.
Yeah, that's so interesting that they're still around, too. And, you know, the mansion burned, and in your article you talk about, because it was a modern building that burned, there's asbestos and all sorts of toxic materials. So you weren't able to approach this like a traditional archaeological site or excavation. Stuff had to go in barrels, and then it went through some kind of remediation. This seems like great lengths to go to get these artifacts. So can you talk a little bit about that?
It was kind of interesting. I was very naive. I thought I would just... So in January of 1981, I went out to the park, brand new park. I went into the burned down ruins. I saw the records and I said, that's kind of groovy, you know, but I didn't think much more about it. There was a big fence around the ruins. They weren't going to go anywhere and the records weren't going anywhere. But I picked up a couple of the discs and looked at them. They still had paper sleeves, cardboard sleeves at that time. By the time I recovered them, most of the sleeves were gone because of, deterioration. However, I realized that someday those records might actually be important, but that wasn't the day, so I didn't try to collect them. Years later, when I decided now it's time to collect them because we're going to be cleaning up the ruins at some point, I naively thought I could just go in and do an excavation. But a couple days before I was supposed to start to dig, I kind of started thinking, what did someone say? And Margaret Purser, archaeologist at Sonoma State.
One of my mentors.
Margie had done a project there for me a few years earlier in which she supervised a crew of prisoners, not her students, but actual prisoners, in cleaning up some of the ruins. And the subject of asbestos had come up. And so I was thinking right before my dig, what did Margie say about asbestos? Just like, I better check. So I had the state do an inspection. And then, of course, they found out asbestos was high and lead was high. So they canceled my dig. So I was left wondering what to do. About 7 years went by, and then the state decided we have to finish cleaning up all this fire debris. So the state funded a hazmat crew to come in to clean it up because they needed to clean up the mansion. And I was able to say, can you please save the area that has the vinyl records? So they were able to shovel those into special 50 55-gallon hazmat drums. And then the drums sat on the site in the park for years until we had more funding to bring in another hazmat crew to do other things. And I was able to get them to piggyback and help me by analyzing everything in these drums. The state wanted to get rid of the drums because there was 27 of them stored in a barn.
Wow.
And this is where the records came from. But in addition to the vinyl records, there was everything else in those drums. Tableware, broken dishes, bottles, clothes, you know, beetle boots, you name it. Anything that these 50 people had in the house when it burned, that didn't completely burn up, was in those drums. So in addition to processing all the records, and there were 94 of them, I had a lot of other things to look at, you know, kids' toys, and you name it. But it was the vinyl records that just really got my attention.
Yeah, I didn't realize that that was what kind of flagged your interest in the site to begin with. That's so cool. But you it sounds like you did get kind of a sweet, a cross-section, I guess, of life inside the commune and you know, what they were eating off of and wearing and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, it was like an unintentional time capsule, you know. Time capsules, we decide what we're going to put in the capsule. But this was an unintentional. So everything went in, including maybe some things that people wouldn't want the future to see, you know, and maybe there was. So it was just all types. The vacuum cleaner. I know what the vacuum cleaner looked like because some of the plastic attachments survived. A couple of melted billiard balls, a handmade roach clip. And when I had some of the commune members come and review the artifacts after I'd cleaned them all up, they all looked at this roach clip and said, "Oh, I know who made that. That was so-and-so. That was his style." So just a lot of interesting things. Yeah,
that is so cool. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and I am talking with Breck Parkman about not-so-ancient archaeology of records in Northern California. So you mentioned you recovered nearly 100 records, most of which have been identified to this at this point. And so you can really get a sense of what tunes people were listening to, you know, all those years ago. And in your article, you describe it as the sonic debris from the Chosen family, which I love that term. But it wasn't the groovy tunes that, well, at least that I would expect. But when you think about a commune, it was show tunes. There was Bill Cosby, Judy Garland, Tony Bennett. And this is not what you'd think about from 60s counterculture. So was it unexpected when you started turning up and identifying these records and that's what they were?
It should not have been unexpected, but it was. If I had been a better anthropologist or a better historian, I would have predicted this is what we would have found. And here's why I say that. If at Thanksgiving, if you go to your extended family's gathering and you have aunts and uncles and sister-in-laws and brother-in-laws and maybe the next-door neighbors there all sharing a meal, if you were to look through their wallets and their purses, you would see quite an eclectic mixture of artifacts. No one person's the same as the other. And if it's multi-generational and multi-ethnic, which the Chosen family was, you're going to bring a lot of different things to the table. In this case, people brought their old music when they came and joined the commune. Doesn't indicate that they were still using and listening to those records, but when they brought their possessions along, that's what they brought. So it was like cultural baggage. And some of the records were being listened to and some were not, but that's who they were. So you have some older members of the commune who, by the time of the Chosen family, were in their 50s. They listened to show tunes when they were younger, and they loved show tunes. They were entertainers. And there was a lady there who listened to country and western, and she brought some country and western music. And so you see the diversity of the people that go together to make up this commune, this Chosen family. And I'm reminded of all the Thanksgiving gatherings I've ever gone to where you have your bigger family, and no one is exactly the same. And when it comes to music, you can go down the table and ask grandpa and grandma and your uncle, what do you listen to? And they probably don't listen to the same music you do. And that's what was happening at Lone Poly. So the records are brought as part of the cultural baggage. They're parked there. Some get listened to, but mostly the later. They were listening to the Beatles' White Album a lot from 68 on, December 68 on. That was a favorite. They'd all get into one bedroom and they listened to it. And but there were the records there. And so that surprised me.
Yeah.
And then one record, there was one record, Burl Ives. And I thought, oh, that must have been one of the grandparents. It turns out it was one of the Grateful Dead albums. The Grateful Dead had lived there right before the Chosen family. And they were associated. The commune and the Grateful Dead were associated. The Grateful Dead would continue to come back after they had moved out. but there was a Burl Ives album from 1965, and I was talking to Bob Ware. We were doing something down there from the Grateful Dead, and I said, look at this record I had on exhibit, and I said, that must have been the more conservative element of the communists. I don't think so. I think we left that here, because we used to love Burl Ives when we were starting out. Jerry Garcia used to, you know, they kind of looked at Burl Ives as one of their mentors. So, you know, like I say, if I had been a better historian, I could have predicted that, but I didn't. And I was surprised, and to be honest, I was delighted, because that's part of the story, because it helps us defeat stereotypes.
Yeah.
There's a stereotype of what a hippie was or is, and the music suggests that that stereotype isn't correct.
Yeah.
Not that any stereotypes usually are correct, but that one especially is off. And the people at Olympoli, they were into high fashion. They dressed up. They were clean. They weren't, we use the words dirty hippie a lot. You hear that. They weren't dirty. And most hippies I remember weren't dirty unless they lived in a commune that didn't have running water. Some did. But here they were into fashion. And you see the photos of these people from the Chosen Family. And they look like movie stars in some cases. It's great.
Yeah.
It's not what I thought a hippie was.
And it gets to what we do, you know, usually as the anthropologist is to try to humanize the past. So here you're taking, you know, the stereotyped image of the hippie, counterculture hippie, but you're adding time depth and complexity and the antecedents that made them interested in, you know, what they and the choices they made as they grew up. So I think that's such a cool, you know, rich data set to add to something that's just now kind of entering the time frame where we start to think about it archaeologically. You know, it doesn't seem like ancient. It's, you know, it's not. It's recent history, but we can still apply those kind of questions and that analysis to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I want to get in the few minutes we have left to talk a little bit about, you know, this is in a book about plastics. And as we get more and more, you know, archaeology just kind of can be 50 years or more, 75 years or more, depending on where you are. But plastics are solidly now in those timeframes. And it's been hard for me to start thinking about, you know, or getting very excited about this as a data set. But this is one, you know, case study that really does show how artifacts that are, you know, modern artifacts can really, you know, offer some insight into the past. So can you speak a little bit, too, about, you know, your work in what would people would consider contemporary archaeology?
Well, you know, I'm very interested in stereotypes. I've always had that interest. So in addition to looking at the term hippie, I've looked at marine, and now I'm looking at witch. So I've done archaeology on a Vietnam-era training ground here in Sonoma County, where I live, where the Marine Corps Reserve trained during the 60s. And I've done a lot of oral histories and interviews. I've done some field archaeological projects looking at, you know, what was left behind during these war games. And the idea of a Marine is kind of like the idea of a witch. You know, what was a Marine? And everybody thinks of John Wayne, you know, in one of his old movies when you think of a Marine. Well, Marines were all different. I mean, they wore the same uniform, but they had different beliefs. They came from different places. They had different cultural baggage. And in the archaeology I've done out at Annandale State Park, I've seen some of that. More recently, you know, when I was an active working state archaeologist, I kept finding really odd sites out in the parks. And some of this was from black magic and some was from green magic. But, you know, a lot of it was from witching and rock alignments and the use of artifacts and arrangements I was finding and things tied to trees. So I got into trying to figure out what that was about. And the first time I used the word witch in a public setting, people chastise me, and it's like, oh, there's another one of those words. You know, it's like using the word hippie. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful. And so for the last few years, I've been looking at some of the archaeology of witchcraft that we find in the greater Bay Area and trying to figure out. And the vast majority of it is what you would probably call green magic, you know, completely harmless, positive energy. Every now and then I'll find something that seems pretty dark. So I've wanted to be able to see the difference between the dark and the green to help with law enforcement and park managers to know the difference. You know, there's some places that, you know, you go right in and clean them up. There's some places that maybe you just leave it for a while. We have a beautiful labyrinth out on the Sonoma coast, discovered 30 years ago after it was made. And I was able to get the state to hands off because it was being used by so many people. And I did interviews and found out that, you know, it wasn't like devil worship. It was people coming out to pray before they went fishing, and it was beautiful, and it's still there, you know, 35 years later. So there's some of this that we can probably, you know, accommodate within the public lands, but we need to know what we can and can't. So the stereotype of what a witch is became very important in my mind.
Yeah.
Just like Marines and also hippies.
And that is such a great note to end on, because I will have you back on the show later. We can talk witches. So that wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. Thank you so much for joining us today, Breck. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and more wherever you get your podcasts.